I'm going to get a fun new thing at work where we got a new location in this old bank building in Kewaunee. And the only bathroom is in the basement. And I don't have very long breaks during my show. And so going up and I have to run up and down those stairs very quickly at the top of the hour.
Oh, jeez. You just wear dark pants.
Sounds like Hidden Figures.
Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick.
I am the smart. I am the smart. S-M-R-T. I mean S-M-A-R-R-T.
And Josh Adams.
My wife. She is pain in my asshole.
Visit us at everyonesacriticpodcast.com, ihatecritics.net, and .com. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, our handle is CriticsPod. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, all your podcatchers. Subscribe to the show, rate and review the show, and if you do leave a review, we will read it on the air, and we got one.
Nice.
What?
Yeah. That's cool.
For the love of everything good and holy, give the host a Red Bull before taping. If he was any more depressive, I'd slip into a coma while listening.
Wait, that was it?
Was that review from your wife?
No, it wasn't. Someone from Canada.
But they give the stars on that.
Two,
zero?
2 out of 5. Oh, wow. So that's not horrible.
Aren't they supposed to be like super friendly?
From my experiences, no. We sell where I work at the day job, we actually sell it to Canada, and they're the worst.
Yeah, I deal with, in my last job, I dealt with Canadian customers a lot as well, but in a tangential sense, I didn't have to directly deal with them, but they were some of the least knowledgeable about their own parts that they could look online about. So in the land where moose roam wild, we have to be told that you're slow. Interesting.
Just kidding.
I do want to reside there. I love Canada. Sorry, fellow countrymen of the future.
And he's right. I mean, I'm boring. So my immediate response when I read it, Corey from IVN, who was here, and I started laughing, and I just handed him my phone, and then he started laughing too. So I could not wait. Oddly enough, I'm the one who postponed the show, but I really wanted to read that review. That's all. So excited about getting to it. But yeah. What else? If you want to be a Patreon supporter, especially if you're from Canada, ihatecritics.net/Patreon is the best way to help support the podcast. You get a credit on the show. There's also a PayPal link on our website, as well as our podcast merch tab where you can buy our t-shirts, or pillows or stickers or whatever else you want to get. News, Box Office Mojo's going to re-release their unlimited plan, sort of.
What's that mean?
Nothing really. They want you to pay for the full year.
Box Office Mojo?
Sorry. I always say box. I always do that. I did it when it was popular. MoviePass.
MoviePass, okay.
I don't know why I interchanged those two. It's the Red Bull fucking mess.
Gives your words wings.
And they fly away and I said the wrong thing. They're doing the unlimited thing again for $9.99, but the catch is you have to pay for a full year in advance, and they have the right to do what they did last time.
Hard pass.
Yes, thanks for playing, but no.
So your Patreon money is going to go to MoviePass. No, we're not going to do that. They still have the tiered thing, but I don't see this working. And you have to give them, instead of a debit card, it's direct access to your checking account. And,
oh, no kidding. Oh,
which,
man.
It's just an ACH payment. There's still only so much they can do, and you do have a little bit of control over that. It's not as scary as it sounds, but still, From what they did, that's not really going to work.
The fact that they're still around is quite something. So there's that.
I've never seen a product or a company hold on for such dear life like them. I mean, maybe like Sears or Toys R Us or something like that. That is constantly going through some sort of bankruptcy or
at least
buyback.
They're successful at one time.
Yes, exactly.
I keep wondering when the shoe's going to drop. They're going to be revealed as like that Theranin, like that awful medical group that was ripping people off with this terrible product that didn't actually exist.
You're going to have to really narrow that down with the medical people ripping people off. but I understand.
I wonder what the scam is. Like, do angel investors think that this thing is going to work eventually and they just keep dumping millions of dollars on top of it just based on the CEO being really, really cool?
Well, from what I understand, they kind of cleaned house and got rid of a lot of people there, and it's almost brand new people in charge. And the idea is good. I mean, trying to get people to the theater, and if theaters were smart, they'd jump on board instead of trying to do their own thing and trying to make this work. But I don't know. It's,
in fairness, too, the supposed plans that each theater chain was going to have, only a few of them are in place. Regal had been talking about it for over a year. They still don't have anything in place, at least in our area, yet.
Then there's James Gunn is not only back for Guardians 3, he's rebooting Suicide Squad, not just making a sequel.
Really? Wow.
Doing both.
Huh. I didn't realize it was a reboot. I mean, I knew they were recasting much of it, but I didn't know that they were going to do a full reboot.
Well, I just saw it on Facebook, whether that's true or not. Literally just saw it.
I know Will Smith
ago.
Isn't coming back because of reasons. I can't imagine they could do it without Margot Robbie, though, considering that she's already got a spinoff.
Yeah, Margot Robbie is a part of the project, and Idris Elba has been cast as Deadshot instead. So, okay, those two starting a movie anyways, I'm fine with, and I would have preferred Idris Elba as at Deadshot to begin with, even though it violates my Marvel and DC role at the same time kind of thing. But he's done with MCU in theory. Okay, but there's another thing that happened today in partnership with this. The CEO of Warner Brothers today, Kevin Sugihara, was stepped down and resigned from his role due to allegations of sexual improprieties. So this is a guy that was the speaking voice for all of these DC projects. And so just today, right after we finally get some more positive news about Suicide Squad being redone again, and James Gunn is still doing it, okay, then we get this. I mean, there's the constant turnover, constant different voices and different ideas. I don't think, per se, that it's going to really affect the future of movies already in motion, but...
Right.
Oh, well, by the way, fuck Mike Cernovich. That was the happiest thing that happened to me the past week, was hearing that James Gunn got rehired, not because of the ridiculousness of it, but because of that. Ah.
Yeah, he was the one, for all you who don't know, that started that dug up all the tweets to throw James Gunn under the bus.
From the town in which I live, Kewaunee, Illinois.
Hog capital of the world.
I can't say I'm all that surprised, honestly. I mean, not that I predicted it or anything.
I did
but,
listen to the episode when I said he's coming back.
I just didn't figure once Chris Pratt and Bradley Cooper and the entire cast basically said we're not coming back, Batista being the most vocal, they pretty much were in a corner where, like, we have to bring him back if we want to continue to the cash cow.
Yeah, give that nice little fake marketing thing of multiple months in between stories, and hopefully it goes away if you don't talk about it, and if you do it again, then it's like, we changed our mind. We had some time to think. They had plenty of time to think. Then, prior to the gig that he got, et cetera, it's all silly, but...
Yeah, I love the fact the way that Disney has to eat shit on this. The second they hear, and maybe it didn't play this way, but he gets Suicide Squad, and they're like, oh shit, other big companies are going to hire him still.
Yeah,
That's the way it looks. I mean, just from the outside, that's the way it looks. And
yeah, everybody. Every time somebody steps in it, they're afraid that they're all right. The crew's over. I'm going to move on. But Kevin Hart kind of kept going.
Yeah, I'll tell you this: the upside played to another sold out house in Davenport this past weekend. I could not believe.
No kidding.
It. I'm blown away. I mean, it's a small house, but still.
Oh, yeah, you seen the Davenport 15 seaters.
Similar to what I sat through with Captive State this week.
Yeah, trailers. We jumped to Avengers Endgame.
Yeah, okay, great, fine, whatever.
Captain Marvel's in it.
Huge spoilers, too, by the way.
She survived the movie? No.
Huge spoilers in the Avengers Endgame trailer. I mean, in case you were worried from the first trailer that maybe Tony Stark doesn't survive. Oh, wait, yes, he does. It's in the fucking trailer.
I didn't catch what part.
It's at the end. He's walking with the entire Avengers group in their new outfits.
I did not see him as part of that group. I will need to watch that again. Good Lord.
Yeah, thanks for putting that in the trailer after you played up the whole thing about maybe he won't make it back. Granted, I assumed he would, but come on, man. Leave the suspense a little bit. Now we just, this here it is in the trailer.
Well, there were plenty of guys that died.
I know, but I mean,
I mean, it's more of a spoiler alert.
I'm annoyed that they put it in the first trailer, like making it a big plot point that he's trapped in space and they don't know how he's going to get back. And then they put it in the second trailer. Oh, there he is. He made it back.
Well, okay. I just want, the movie needs to get here now. I mean, we've been waiting for this forever. I'm glad that they dropped the trailer because it was a nice little surprise last week. But it didn't do anything for me additionally, except we did see more of Hawkeye. That makes me very happy. I think I like his outfit. I like his haircut. I like the look on his face. Hopefully this is our moment for Hawkeye to shine.
I mean, people have been making fun of that haircut, though, a lot. Like, really? So your kids turn to dust and you get that haircut?
If I had that much hair, I might cut it like that, you know? Nah, I'm not cool enough for that. I'd have to be, like, cut like Jeremy Renner. But
it's just not practical, I guess, what people are saying.
True.
It's like, why is Hawkeye suddenly stylish? Like, what's going on with that? He's a dad with a couple of kids and wife at home who wanted to be retired, and now he's, you know, ninja hair.
Ronan, isn't it? It's kind of like that. not 100%. Bob, what did you think? I know that you are on the edge of your seat with these movies. So.
I mean, it didn't do anything more, it didn't do anything less. You know, this is supposed to be a pretty dark and dramatic movie, and then you got this little joke of Thor and the hammer coming by Captain Marvel. It's like, I want a consistent tone. That's all I want out of these movies. And really, when they started going funny and light, it doesn't bother me. I like some of those movies, but it makes me less invested. You know, as soon as really Age of Ultron, when they started catching everybody that fell out of the buildings and making sure nobody died that was innocent at all, that it really did kind of hurt everything after that, and for me.
But that's an interesting point you make about the tone and about the humor, and we're going to have to reel in Thor a little bit here pretty soon, because, I mean, I loved Ragnarok. But we pushed him way too far, maybe, and this continuing to make him a comedy character, got to pull that back a little bit.
I like Ragnarok as a standalone movie. When you put it in the universe, I hate it. That's really when it started to shift. I know Guardians was already there, but they were their own entity. That just was like, you're mixing Iron Man and Guardians and making Thor, you know, Chris Pratt meets Robert Downey Jr. in it. It worked in the movie, but it doesn't work in the universe for me. And now I think everybody else is starting to see it. Again, I was ahead of the curve.
When Endgame comes out on Blu-ray and we have...
Energetic enough for you, Canada.
Hey, we have a full-on smile from Bob. You can't see it, but it's really there. Once Endgame comes out on Blu-ray and we have the opportunity to watch like everything... Up until that point, as I understand, it's going to be called like the Infinity Era or something like that. They've labeled like all of this the Infinity Era. I kind of want to go through all of them again and kind of in a row and see what doesn't fit. You know, give like a really hard criticism of everything and see like finally the order that it should be instead of relying on my one time or two time memories of it.
You want to do this before Endgame or after?
After. After. When Endgame gets on Blu-ray. There's no, I can't do that.
Josh will not be on the podcast for the next 3 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever it is. I'd be honest. I'd be somewhat interested in that to an extent. I don't know. But at the same time, I don't know that I care to watch Doctor Strange at all. I haven't seen it yet. I think that's the only one I haven't seen, as far as I know. And then Good Boys.
I actually missed this trailer, so.
Whoops. So did I. Unless I saw it and I don't remember it.
It's a Seth Rogen movie.
Okay.
Who is the kid from Room?
Jacob Tremblay.
And like an NC-17 kids swearing right and left type movie. The trailer opens up with Seth Rogen setting the three boys down going, "You guys can't see this trailer. You're in the movie. You said everything. But you're not allowed to see it. So we're going to put this trailer." And then they're like, "Why the fuck not?" And blah, blah, blah. And it's super bad for grade schoolers.
Wow.
So
who can't see it in theory? I'm sorry, I didn't see this one, but it looks kind of interesting.
I mean, I think it looks funny, but I'm also a big Seth Rogen fan. And I was curious your opinion just because you got Seth Rogen, but you have Jacob Tremblay, who really hasn't disappointed you yet, as far as I know. Throwing him in Superbad. I'm curious if, I mean, I don't know. But yeah, you'll have to watch the trailer sometime.
Kind of reminds me of Bad Words, the Jason Bateman movie from a few years ago, but kicked up a notch because it's kids.
Yeah, but I mean, they're going through like a high school, whatever, however old they are. Maybe it's junior high at this point. He's been around a couple of years, and kids grow fast. But whatever that age group is, kind of going through a day, is a lot like Superbad in terms of the style.
Then again, after knowing what some things have been said to my son that I've seen, they pretty much probably do that anyways.
Oh, yeah. They definitely do it. Speaking of funny, you guys know the whole Momo thing, right?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
I was at Corey's house over the weekend, and he has an Apple TV, and he can control it from his phone, and somehow he just popped the search up and just started typing Momo Says Hi. And all the kids came running downstairs crying. Almost immediately regretted it.
After he stopped laughing.
I laughed from the get-go. His wife wasn't as... I mean, it was pretty funny.
Careful, we're going to make the Canadian comatose. I'm very depressed.
It's 8:45 and I'm drinking Red Bull. I'm going to be up all night. Yeah. Just for you, Canada. Wonder Park,
yeah.
This Bring it back down.
Yeah, no kidding. This movie didn't have a director credited. Did you know that? They had to actually fire the director about a year ago for inappropriate behavior. And so the last year of the film's development, they actually didn't have a director. And you can really tell in how this thing plays out because it feels like kind of a rudderless ship. The idea here is basically taking elements of Inside Out and other movies about kids' emotional growth and putting it inside this theory of a theme park. So basically this little girl, June, she has this theme park that she's invented in her head with her mom, played by Jennifer Garner. And the mom will whisper a thing into the monkey's ear and the monkey creates it in her imagination and blah, blah, blah. Turns out that later on, after mom gets pretty cancer and disappears from the movie, the kid actually discovers that the theme park is real in the forest, and because she stopped playing with it when mom went away with cancer, the theme park has become dilapidated and overrun by zombies, and her friends who are in her imagination, her stuffed animals, are real, and they're having to kind of try and save the park, and she's got to try and get her imagination going again so she can herself save the park.
And of course, all that's about coming to terms with where she is in her life with her mom being sick. And I'm being flippant about that because I thought the movie was kind of flippant about that, honestly, the way that they play it out. Jennifer Garner just sort of disappears, and then the kid, you know, becomes unimaginative and has to kind of rediscover her imagination. And it's not very well played because it's not very funny, or it's not, and it's not very dramatic. And the set pieces aren't very strong. And the one character that you would think would be this really emotional link to this character, which would be the monkey, that's the kind of the centerpiece of their imaginative little world, Peanut, is not a very good character. They play up that Peanut has gone missing when she arrives in Wonder Park or Wonderland in the movie. Because again, here's another lazy aspect of this. No one ever calls this thing Wonder Park. The only thing that calls it Wonder Park is on the trailer and the title of the poster. That's it. It's never referred to as Wonder Park in the movie at all. It's referred to as Wonderland. But, you know.
I mean, I get why, but at the same time, it's just like, we'll just call it Wonder Park then. If you want to confuse it with the Alice movie, call it Wonder Park in the movie.
Yeah, exactly. No, they call it Wonderland in the movie. It makes no sense. But the character of Peanut should be this important thing that's a link to her mom, and he's missing it when she arrives in the park. And so you think, oh, that's going to be a big thing, her finding Peanut, and that's going to be the connection with her reconnecting with her mom in some way, an emotional level. No, they just give that away just immediately without, and the character has really no connection with the mom in the end, which is kind of, these are just those little things that a director who's paying attention is kind of giving all of his attention to this, might have find a way to at least paper over and, you know, cover up the holes that are here in the plot. And without a director, without that one guiding hand who's in charge of everything, and I'm not saying that an animation director is as important as a regular director, because there's so many things that go into an animated movie. Like, a lot of this was done before they even fired him. So, I mean, literally the final elements of it that were coming together after they'd fired him. But I think there are elements here that a caring director who had had a firm hand on it the whole way might have been able to fix or at least paper over the worst troubles of it. And without that, you see lots of bigger holes and lots of bigger problems with this movie. It's not terrible. The animation's really good. But the voice cast is very typical. Ken Jeong and Kenan Thompson are characters you don't even know what they are. Animal-wise, I think they're woodchucks. You know, but they're who they are. They do their shtick like you expect them to. And Mila Kunis and John Oliver are fine. Matthew Broderick is fine as the dad. Nobody really stands out. And that's really nothing really about this movie stands out.
I really love roller coasters in general. And my only excitement in my head about this one, not that my son wanted to see it or not that I actually did see it, was the idea of really cool and daring roller coasters. I don't know if you guys have ever seen any of those completely improbable roller coaster videos that seem like they're fake.
Yes.
Good portion of them are, I'm sure. But it makes me kind of sick to my stomach, and I am drawn to that thrill, though, just like going to a park. And so this movie got me for a second thinking maybe they'll celebrate the joy of roller coasters, but that doesn't sound at all like what it is.
No.
I was wondering if they had Wonderland as the title at some point, but then they got word of this whole bringing up Neverland Ranch again, and so maybe they decided not to have it too close to that.
I think it's more akin to somebody's already got the copyright on Wonderland and, as a title.
Okay.
And they just and the only title that I think is used Wonderland is that John Holmes movie with Val Kilmer. But I don't think that's I think there are other uses of Wonderland out there probably that forced them to go with Wonder Park, but just change it in the movie to Wonder Park. So silly.
Yeah. I am curious how that, like, I'm just thinking that, like, what is the rule? I mean, obviously, we probably don't know the answer, but at what point can the director not be forced to have his name on it? Like, Bohemian Rhapsody, they fired Bryan Singer, but he still got his name on it.
Mm-hmm.
Curious.
It's a fair question. I have no honest answer. I mean, he was fired in January of 2018, and you figure with the amount of time it takes to make an animated movie, he had to get through most of it.
Right.
Yeah, gosh, did it have actual Alan Smithy as a director
credit?
There's literally no director credited, yeah.
That is very interesting as to how they could get away with that. I'm almost interested in finding out the rules for the Directors Guild and as it applies, what is literally like the point in time when it crosses over and you must give credit.
Do you know who the guy's name is?
I did. I wrote about it in my review, but I don't have it in my head.
5 feet apart.
5 feet apart. This is a story of kids with cystic fibrosis, which is, I guess, a relatively new topic for a movie, at the very least. I don't know if we've seen cystic fibrosis portrayed in a movie, and it's done by a director who is familiar with the subject. He directed a documentary that was about patients near the end of their lives, and one of the patients was a CF patient. So he does take good care to be careful about how he portrays the disease, and that I certainly can appreciate. Other than that, there's not much to appreciate here. Aside from Haley Lou Richardson, who's a real movie star, and it's unfortunate that she's acting beneath her talent in this movie. These characters and this plot are just not good enough for her. The idea here is that two kids with cystic fibrosis begin a relationship while in the hospital, but cystic fibrosis patients are very susceptible to each other's bacteria, and so there's a rule in hospitals that all CF patients have to stay at least 6 feet apart. The plot here is that as these two begin to form their romantic relationship, the one thing she wants to do is at least take back this 1 foot. So she makes it 5 feet apart. She has a pool cue even that she uses that's 5 feet long that they use to basically have a date and make a plot about that's how they hold hands. They walk with this pool cue between them.
Anything else on 5 feet apart?
Well, I was just kind of making the point that I think that Haley Lou Richardson's a really great actress, and I think this type of material that relies so heavily on creating forced drama about just how far apart they are from each other, it really is just beneath her, and it's really beneath the movie too, with what it's dealing with in terms of cystic fibrosis. Is like just this they're so reckless about the blocking and about how far apart they are, and you're just sitting there almost like, you're almost on the edge of your seat wondering just like, oh gosh, they're within 4 feet of each other. Oh no, they're much closer than that pole. That pole isn't even 5 feet long. And it's like stupid shit like that you're spending time focusing on. But then they both end up jumping into a pool together. It's like, really? First of all, as somebody with asthma, I'm offended, let alone somebody with cystic fibrosis who already has a hard time breathing. You're in a pool?
without checking the water chemistry?
Exactly. But in a hospital, why does a hospital have a pool to begin with?
Is that supposed to be like, diving into the deep end is a metaphor for living life, you know, to the fullest?
I don't know, but really? I was really annoyed with that scene. Then they started splashing each other. I'm like, really? First of all, he has a version of CF that you can't even get a lung transplant with. So it's the most dangerous form. Like, he is about to die. And then she's got the chance to at least get 5 more years with her lung transplant, and she's risking it with this guy. There's a lot of elements of this that just don't work. Aside from Haley Richardson, who's a really amazing actress, Cole Sprouse is kind of forgettable to me. I kept honestly mixing him up. I thought he was Timothy Chalamet's brother or something. Like, he looks like him, but he's not nearly the actor or the presence that he is.
Got a hell of a name, though. Got a movie star name.
Cole Sprouse?
His brother's even better. Dylan Sprouse.
They're Sprouse twins.
Sprouse kind of.
They were the twins on Full House, weren't they?
Friends. They played Ben. Oh, okay. David Schwimmer's kid.
Is that why he's named Ben?
No. Also not because of Ben Kenobi. Which I had not
Liar!
Thought of that until she was 6 months pregnant, and then I had to defend myself. No, it's not because of Ben Kenobi, but it works.
But Haley Lou Richardson, you really want to enjoy what incredible talent she is. You have to see Columbus with her and John Cho. That movie is incredible. It's one of the
most underseen movies of the last 3 years. I think it's absolutely an utter masterpiece, directed by a first-time director named Koganata, who really has just an amazing, for a first-time director, he has an amazing grasp of film language. And my favorite thing I've ever written, I wrote about this movie. So I urge you to see Columbus, and that would be the thing. Or support The Girls, for that matter, which just came out last year, which she was a minor part of, but she was really great in.
Captive State.
Captive State is directed by Rupert Wyatt, who directed Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which is a really good movie, and he's a really talented director. The story here is that aliens have invaded Earth and taken over for the most part. Most governments across the world have given up, and are many of the most elite and leaders of the world, the rich of the world, are cooperating with them and leaving behind the rest of the world to die, essentially. And the rest of the world is kind of, there's little pockets of freedom fighters here and there who are fighting back. And one of those freedom fighter pockets is in this area of Chicago where the story is set. The younger brother of a freedom fighter, Gabriel, is looking for a way to get out of this Chicago neighborhood. He wants to try and figure out a way to get out and get away to this mythical zone that might be free of the aliens and of the legislators, who are the people who are cooperating with the aliens. But he's got to get a thing to a guy in order to get another thing to get him out. And there's we've seen versions of that plot before. It's not very original, and it's okay here. I kind of like the way they play it. Rupert Wyatt is a very good director, so he sets up a scene where he has to obtain a phone number while he's at work, where he's very heavily monitored at his job by the, you know, the people who are cooperating with the aliens. And he's got to figure out a way to get this phone number that's written on the side inside of a cigarette out of the building without getting caught. And we see, as he's doing that, another person who's trying to sneak something out get caught and taken away. And we see kind of, it underlines the danger that he's in doing this. And I love the precarious way he's got the cigarette behind his ear, trying to pretend that it's nothing, just a cigarette. And I like there's a really great tension to that series of scenes that is really well edited and put together. And there's a lot of that in this movie that's very well edited and put together. The biggest issue that I had with this movie is in the casting. These faces of these characters who become so important, and this is an ensemble cast. Gabriel is kind of the lead, but for the most part, it's an ensemble cast because he disappears for much of the second act. You're left with a lot of characters who you're looking at going, wait, him? That's the one I'm following? Is it that one? Is it that guy? You don't know their names. These people have names that I wrote in my review. I don't remember these people. I can barely remember their face. And that's not to say that they're bad actors. It's just they don't have that innate quality. And I actually wrote about your guy, Ben Mendelsohn, in my review. One thing you can say about Ben Mendelsohn is that you may not recognize the name Ben Mendelsohn when you hear it, but when he's on camera, the camera you don't have to go looking for him. The camera goes to look for him. It's drawn to him. And the same goes for guys like Harry Dean Stanton or Ned Beatty, these character actors whose faces, Margot Martindale's another one. You're drawn to them. The camera is drawn to them. They have an innate quality that takes you to them and automatically gives you this familiarity and comfort with them that you don't get with characters you don't recognize, actors who don't have that kind of presence and that kind of identifiability. And you need that when you're telling a story like this that is kind of kinetic and very fast-paced. If you can't grab onto those faces with your eyes, you're going to lose track of what's going on. And there's a big set piece involving four actors who are basically the entirety of the second act in this very important thing that they're doing. And you can't keep track of any of these people. I mean, you're lucky if you can figure out which one is Kevin J. O'Connor, who's maybe the best known of these, maybe the most recognizable face. And even he's kind of hard to keep track of when you're watching this. And that's really unfortunate. It's really a shame that the casting really lets this movie down. John Goodman is the biggest name actor in the movie, and his part is predictable and rather perfunctory. Vera Farmiga is the other well-known name, and she's barely in the movie. And that's really unfortunate as well, because she's kind of got some of the most intriguing stuff in the entire movie, and they barely use her. She's got my favorite line in the movie where she just repeats this kind of old slogan about never trust a what is it
a Greek
bearing gifts. Yeah, that's a really great line, and it sets up something that's very important later on in the movie, and I dug that. There's a lot of good things about this movie, but it's just not quite good enough because it doesn't have that identifiability that you would get from a better cast and a more recognizable cast, ones that really you have that automatic identifiability with, that you really jump in and know. Like, if I saw Ben Mendelsohn in those scenes, I would know that's Ben Mendelsohn, and I know to follow him, and he's the guy we're with. These people, I kept losing them in the crowd.
This is very typical of a film released at this particular time of year, maybe even February or January, where you have something of a high concept that's going to be edited well, but you can tell that all of the money is spent on backdrops and demolition and explosions and the few special effects that we do see, which the aliens themselves are barely on screen, and I guess that's where they put their money. But you've got a cast that, as you said, very unrecognizable and very unmemorable, for that matter. I believe that the lead, Gabriel, is the teenage version in Moonlight of the main character, if I'm not mistaken. But that's the thing. I'm not sure because I can't put myself with him. And we need to care about him. We need to care about his family in this movie. This is one of the more out-of-place films that I've seen in a long time. It exists almost like between a couple of movies that we don't get to see. Somebody else brought that up, too. Of all things, I think Geek Tyrant mentioned it's a sequel to a film we haven't seen. I'm like, okay, actually, they've got it. Because that's how I felt. I didn't see what came before this, which is more interesting. And I didn't see what came after this film, which is also already more interesting. The end of the film doesn't give me any sort of payoff whatsoever. I'm not always needing that, but I've spent 2 hours with this cast and with this idea. I at least want to see inside these boulder ships or something like that. At least a shitty movie like Skyline, for example, all the way back from 2010, gave me the ability to see all of the terrible special effects right before our eyes. This is disappointing on a number of levels. It doesn't mean anything. Is it trying to tell us that we're under surveillance too much, and so they used an alien invasion as kind of like a metaphor for our current world of technology? Maybe, because the film even shows that cameras are on everything, including when you're making love to your loved one, okay? But so many things are left out, and we're meant to believe that they're important that don't come back. Gabriel's girlfriend, what does she matter to the plot? Not at all. And that actress is from Ready Player One. She is a recognizable face. They don't use her. This big thing that happens in the middle of the film, what does it actually do? I mean, they keep saying it's the match that gets striked and lights the fire. And I'm like, oh, so that's kind of like what they said in The Last Jedi. You know, it's been used before. The Road talked about a flame, you know, lasting forever and keeping the flame going. I guess of all of the disappointing things that I can see, I kind of championed this in my head as being like a smaller scale, maybe smarter alien invasion film. And I'm always up for some kind of apocalypse on film because I want to see what a director feels about humans and what they're going to do. And in this situation, he really just wants to show a heist spy type movie against the background of aliens. It's like if District 9 were really boring.
Well, I think District 9 is pretty boring, but
depending on your point of view, from a certain point of view, Sean. But Captive State is unfortunately one of the most boring things I've seen in a long time as a result. There are some smart things that just don't mean anything. It's a thriller without thrills. It's got tension with no purpose.
It reminded me a lot of there was a TV show on TNT with Noah Wyle not all that long ago that was pretty popular. The name of it escapes me. Similar in premise and idea and execution as well. And I think this could actually be very successful as a television show where you'd have time to get to know these characters and these actors in those characters. But without that level of time investment, you don't have that identifiability. And without that, this this plot doesn't really work nearly as well. And that's a shame, because Rupert Wyatt is a really talented director. Rise of the Planet of the Apes is a hell of a movie that does metaphor far better than this one does, which is much more muddled in terms of what it's going for. Because you mentioned the surveillance plot, but there's also the 99% or the 100, you know, the 1 versus 100 kind of idea, you know, the rich versus the poor idea, that's also in there. And the growing divide between the people who have money and the people who don't, that's a big part of this as well. But it's much more muddled because we don't have enough time to let it develop.
All I'm picking up out of this is it worked better as a TV show, or if Noah Wiley was in the movie. At least they have a face you recognize.
Exactly, yeah.
A name we haven't said on the podcast yet in however many years. And it might be another 5 years.
Well, we might have
years.
Mentioned it when we saw Donnie Darko, and that's about
but
it.
But I'm not sure we did.
I think I reviewed a movie of his called Shot a few years ago, in which he played a guy who got shot.
Possible you just wrote about it? Apollo 11.
Apollo 11. This is a documentary assembled by a footage assemblage of footage of the 1969 moon landing that is newly remastered and some of it rediscovered. There was a lot of this stuff that they had thought they'd completely lost, which is definitely valuable. I don't know how much I can say about this movie, though, because I'm mistakenly took a Claritin not all that long before I saw this movie, so I kept nodding off.
Non-drowsy Claritin. Bullshit. I'm with you.
Not me.
I don't know. I
need to get the Claritin D. They make crystal meth out of the D part. They really do, and that helps you stay wired. Or drink a Red Bull.
That's a good tip. I don't want to say this documentary is boring. I don't think it is. I was really fascinated by the idea of it. But honestly, I took a Claritin before I saw it, and I just kept nodding off a lot during this movie.
Did you get to see it, Josh? Sounds right up your alley.
It certainly does, but I was expecting that I wouldn't have to see another movie about Apollo 11 after First Man came out, and I'm still wanting, yet I took my time and wasted it this weekend seeing Captive State versus this documentary. Go figure. I also forgot that you mentioned it was coming.
It's St. Patrick's Day. We're all out drinking and having a good time.
Yeah. The one place on Earth I would rather not be is Davenport on St. Patrick's Day for the parade.
Me as well. The night before, though, a couple people came here. That my wife, she skipped work. A lot of people skipped work and went drinking on Friday to avoid the Sunday and Saturday crowd. Then I worked. They came to my house afterward. And oddly enough, they started talking about the moon and how, like, would you go to the moon? And I was like, from the get-go, I was just like, no, I don't really care. Before they could even get to, would you go, would you give up this? And I'm like, straight up, I wouldn't go. But what would you give up to go to the moon?
Just the moon?
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
But you start talking to me about Europa? Probably everything. I mean, this is known by all loved ones in my life. I've discussed my point of view. This is not meant to be news to them or anything like that, or meant to hurt their feelings. It's
goodbye,
it's
wife. Bye, son. They're letting me go to Europa. See ya.
There's a big fuck you on the spaceship.
I'm like Matthew McConaughey in Interstellar. You know? I feel like the good of mankind, you know, is worth one human life, that kind of thing. I really do abide by that. And I mean, if it was something grander and had a purpose, first of all, they'd get somebody much more qualified than me. But
well, that's the reason if we go back to the moon only, though, that's what it came down to is, would you give up sex for the rest of your life? And I'm like, well, that's like a month long trip tops.
I mean, the moon? Yeah.
Well, it's 3 days there, 3 days back. You might hang out a little bit, stop at the space station. I don't know.
Do some orbiting.
Even if I wanted to go, that would definitely be off the table. But people are like, yeah, in a heartbeat. And I'm like, you're insane.
It's a little too dangerous for me. I like to see other people do that. Like, I don't know. I went to Virgil Grissom Elementary, and I think you know what happened to Virgil Gus Grissom in 1968. So, yeah, that's all right. I'll let somebody else take that chance.
I'm the one on the show here tonight that has mentioned how much I love roller coasters and I'm drawn to the thrill of it. So, yeah, sign me up. That would be so awesome, though. I mean, to be one of the few people, which notoriety doesn't matter to me because you can't hear everyone giving you notoriety, you're billions of miles away. But there's something to be said about deep space travel. If somebody wanted to freeze me and send me off into deep space in like some long-term engine, you know, like the Voyager was, but you know, a modern type of mission, yeah, absolutely.
Once again, Josh says screw his family.
That's a joke.
It's hard, of course it's hard to say like it's hard to say that out loud, but if you are up front with the people that you care about and say like, this is what I would do if it was ever offered to me, it's not your offense, but it's a hard thing to swallow. It's almost like you know, if one person in a relationship believes in Jesus and the other one doesn't or something, then it's like, I can't be with somebody that doesn't love Jesus or something like that. You know, right. It's that kind of divide.
It does explain the first man fight we had.
But I said it jokingly, but it makes sense because you're really putting yourself in that guy's shoes and why, you know, he probably had the conversation that you've had, and obviously they don't show it in the movie, but, you know, it kind of makes sense, and it makes it less of a, you know, the him too joke goes even further out the window.
Sure.
That's kind of what I'm
sure. I think it really makes you focus on really getting to the nitty gritty of what your purpose is in the world and what our purpose is.
Right.
The discussion has been had in many fictional things that I like, but it's an interesting conversation to have with anybody that you care about, you know, friends, family, son, what have you. I've discussed it with my son. He's at least not outwardly against it. So, take
that as you. Well, and here's the reason I wouldn't go even for free is mainly because I know enough people that really want to go, and I'd just feel bad doing it. I'm not, like, I'm a dick, but I wouldn't be like, oh, fuck you guys. I don't even like the moon.
Yeah, you're like Tom Skerritt in Contact.
I don't know what that means.
That's a perfect answer.
I have a radical idea. We'll cross the streams.
Excuse me, Egon. You said crossing the streams was bad.
Cross the streams.
You're going to endanger us. You're going to endanger our client.
Not necessarily. There's definitely a very slim chance we'll survive.
Jason from New Mexico. Sorry. He told me to use that clip. Or he told me to use the earlier one in the movie, and I was like, I like this one better. We'll probably talk about it more next week. We'll be quick. Triple Frontier came out on Netflix. Josh and I saw it. Sean did not.
I did not.
Oh, you didn't see it?
So you are.
Then I will be quick because we'll talk about it more next week, I'm sure. I like it.
All right.
I would have gone to the theater to see it. Huh.
Triple Frontier is on Netflix with Oscar Isaac, Ben Affleck, and really an all-star cast.
Yeah. Charlie Hunnam and then two guys that look alike. It's true.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But it's you know you're thinking Three Kings going in, and quickly you kind of get out of that because they kind of do that whole movie right off the bat, and I found it to be a pretty good action flick, you know, not much more than that. But early on, I thought the acting was a little rough, but I mean, you got Oscar Isaac and Ben Affleck, it's gonna get there, and I thought it did, and I thought it was, I hesitate to say fun because it gets a little dark, but it's I enjoyed it. I would have seen it in the theater. I probably would have gone this week to see that movie in the theater. So,
listen up, Netflix.
We'll talk about it more next week.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized undisputed classic.
I really just wanted to play the sound clip for the Cross the Streams. Bringing Out the Dead.
Yeah, Bringing Out the Dead. You know, I referenced before we started that I made a mistake this weekend, and I'm assuming you thought it was the Claritin, and actually it was a mistake related to watching this movie, because I'm a huge fan of Bringing Out the Dead. I have been since it came out back in 99, And the mistake I made was this week, I thought, okay, I'm going to be a real, like, film scholar this time. I sat down on Saturday morning and decided I'm going to do scene by scene and really just dig in to all the themes. And this was a massive mistake. Because, really, this movie, I should have just sat and watched it. I might have enjoyed it. Instead, I didn't enjoy it nearly as much as I used to, because I was watching it scene by scene and writing everything down that I was thinking, and I hit upon all these things that I don't like about it. Now, that said, I think there's a lot of great things about Bringing Out the Dead. This is, of course, Nicolas Cage as the star, directed by Martin Scorsese. And Cage plays an ambulance driver who's kind of at the end of his rope. He's sleepless and drunk and kind of losing faith. He's lost a lot of patience lately. He's not been able to save anybody. And he feels like he's kind of at the end of his tether, and he doesn't quite know where to go from here. And the world is kind of falling apart around him, and everywhere around him is chaos. The hospital, his co-workers, especially his co-workers, John Goodman, Ving Rhames, Tom Sizemore, all increasing levels of crazy, it would seem, and very loud caricatures in many ways. I really enjoy the look of this movie. It's a great looking movie. It's a very unique looking movie. The great watery streets and the reflections and off the streets and the way he uses rain in the movie is fantastic. The soundtrack is amazing. You know, this, although I was, again, the thing that threw me off right away is that this movie is set in the early 90s. It's the first thing that you see in the movie, and then that plays absolutely no role in the rest of the movie. He didn't need to tell us that in any way, because then the movie right immediately leans into Van Morrison's TB Sheets is the song that you hear at the very start of the movie, and it's kind of plays as sort of the main theme of this movie. It'll come back a number of times throughout, and that song's about a guy essentially who's trapped in a room with a woman with TB and kind of desperately, you know, looking for a breath of fresh air. And that's reflective of Nicolas Cage. He's in a room, he's essentially trapped inside his own head, desperate for some fresh air. He's getting away from his own guilt that's kind of clouding everything that he does. So that song is great, but that song came out in 68. you just told me that your movie is set in the 90s, and then immediately the soundtrack follows that up with, like, The Who and Bellboy, and that follows up with Johnny Thunders, You Can't Wrap Your Arms Around a Memory, which is another early 70s song, and suddenly you're throwing off this idea that this is set in the very early 90s. Why did you tell me that? What role does that play? So immediately my mind starts to wander all through all these questions, and then the thing that really hit me hard this time as I'm going through this and really kind of doing a deep dive is this character of Rose that is referenced throughout the movie. It's not just, you know, it's not just a couple times, it's constant. It's this constant thing, this reference to this ghost, to this girl that he wasn't able to save. And it grows tiresome eventually, and I was really surprised by that, because it resonated with me the first time, and it didn't resonate with me so much this time. The other aspects worked. Like, Cliff Curtis is still really fantastic. This is one of the best performances of his career, playing this very oily drug dealer who takes in Patricia Arquette character. She's kind of a recovering drug addict named Mary, another one of those Catholic references, and her innocence is going to be tested by possibly going back to this life before she became virginal. He's really fantastic. And then his death scene is amazing. That is a phenomenal Scorsese scene. I really amazing thing. And there are aspects, like they said, that are really great. And then there are other things that I was just really nagging at me. The Rose thing really nagged at me. There are other elements of it. The comedy, the dark comedy, kind of gets tiresome after a little while, especially with Mary Beth Hurt.
Mary Beth Hurt,
see, thank you.
You're doing the same thing as I did a couple weeks ago.
Mary Beth Hurt. She is this character who's this nurse she's the intake nurse at the hospital, and they do the same bit with her over and over again about her saying, "Well, you're a drunk and you fell down and busted your head. Why do you think I should help you?" They do that same bit. "Well, you're a drug dealer who's been, you know, putting poison in your veins. Why do you think we should help you?" Now, over and over again, they do that bit.
and it's fine. It's not bad. I just kind of grew. It's like, okay, I get it. The thing about this is a good aspect, though, to return just briefly to the conversation about Captive State. One thing about Scorsese is with his side characters are amazing. The side characters in the hospital, every one of them has a color to them. Even if you don't know their names, their faces draw you. Ada Turturro has a very small role as Nurse Krupp, but she is fantastic. She's charismatic. She draws you in. She has unique qualities. There's just a security guard whose whole thing is wearing sunglasses inside, but that character is indelible. You remember him throughout the entire movie. Nestor Serrano as Dr. Hazmat is another. You know, he's a guy who's kind of there for a little bit of exposition, but at the same time, he's very colorful. He talks really fast, and he's really compelling. And that's a great thing. Mary Beth Hurt, again, a colorful character, memorable qualities. The same goes for Ving Rhames and Tom Sizemore. Those are all, of course, recognizable faces, those two guys. But just the color that he gives each of those characters, and he gives them a little something to do and a little something to remember them by that I think a lot of directors fail to do. It's that level of detail that Scorsese has that a lot of directors don't. I don't love Bringing Out the Dead as much as I did when I saw it for the first time in 99 and saw it again a few years after that, but that's my own fault, I think.
Josh?
I saw this with a guy who's my best friend who was about to go to EMT school at the time, and we both loved it. And the thing is, 20 years does a lot for your film abilities, you know, at least in theory. And what I liked about it this time are all of the side characters. The dark humor works for me. The performance by Mark Anthony, of all people, it took me to the end to realize, oh my gosh, that's Mark Anthony as Noel, an addicted man who is just wants a cup of water. He, for Christ's sake, he just wants a cup of water. But he's dangerous, but also funny and sympathetic at the same time. That really works for me. Tom Sizemore's character is just bonkers. For whatever reason, he starts hitting his own ambulance with a baseball bat towards the end of the film. He can't kill his vehicle, is what he says. He can't kill the ambulance. It doesn't die on him. And so he's apparently just trying to beat it because it's not giving him what he wants. I don't know about the decisions on these
characters.
I hear
he was method acting.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me at all because we know a little bit more about Tom Sizemore these days than we did then. But this is like a fever dream of a movie. I'll take the camera work in this one, not just the rain and the foggy imagery of the camera looking straight through the ambulance, but also the way that it zooms in, zooms out, goes fast, goes slow. It's like, for a moment, you're wondering if it's an unreliable narrator because of how much it diverts different paces throughout the film. What I don't like are the things that you said. The Rose scenes get very tiresome. Redemption is heavy in this one, obviously. The film ends redemptively. That's fine maybe once or twice, but I started to feel a little overkill with that one, too. I started to feel a little overkill with the way that people treat each other in this movie, and then I remembered I'm not a New Yorker and I don't understand this thing, but so be it, okay? But most of all, it just seems like a tier two Scorsese movie compared to, say, The Departed, even Goodfellas. I've got to give Goodfellas that credit. There's a gravitas in that film that doesn't exist here. And people might say The Departed is a tier two Scorsese movie, but I kept telling myself, no, don't shoot yourself in the face on this one. It's our Scorsese movie, as you always say. But I did enjoy this movie, but definitely not as much as the first time. I sent a text to my friend. Now he's a firefighter in the local area, and he's got 15 years of EMT work and being a firefighter. I said, hey, I'm watching this movie. You remember watching it? It was almost 20 years ago now. He said, yeah, I can't watch that movie again. and I can't blame him. So the idea of this movie being a fever dream for people in the healthcare industry, especially ER workers, oh, I feel for them so much. They're saints for the most part. So I get the angle, but it's not a great movie.
I love when I'm ahead of the curve. I guess I liked it more, but at the same time, I'm with you guys. It's, I think, you know, we mentioned Cape Fear and, you know, the King of Comedy, and then this one. This is a Paul Schrader written one. So now you got Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, and then this, and Last Temptation of Christ. This is the fourth best of the four of those. it's not bad. It's Scorsese doesn't really do bad.
No.
But it's just hard to compare it to those two. It's one of those that's kind of different than a normal Scorsese movie. He's not usually the dark humor guy. He's not, you know, this is something more Tarantino would do or something like that. And he does it just fine. There's no plot. But at the same time, you know, when you're driving an ambulance, there's no plot. You just kind of, it's all ER stuff. And so there's kind of a purpose for that. But it looks good. There's great acting in it. It's definitely watchable. It's just one of those where you're not... Like, I was worried I was missing something when I didn't like it the first time. And again, when I say didn't like it, it was like, you're going in there with Scorsese. This is going to be my Scorsese movie. And when it wasn't The Departed like I wanted it to be. Obviously, The Departed came out like 10 years later. But that's kind of... I was at the age where I was going to finally have my Scorsese movie, and it came years later. But again, it's good. It's fine. It's just not what I thought it was, what I wanted it to be initially. And even now, I realize I got it. It just, it wasn't my favorite thing he's done.
How does the modern Nicolas Cage affect the way you look at this Nicolas Cage?
That's a really good question. I don't think I'm as much of a fan of his in general. Because he's always been kind of a funny-looking dude. That does something to me. Like, if you don't have classic movie star looks, it's not his fault. It's just I don't find him to be, like, a guy that I go with, you know? It's kind of like a guy that I run alongside when I'm watching his movies. And I also haven't seen as many of his movies as you guys have. Some of these smaller ones, like the Army of One movie, for example, I really got my indoctrination when it was like Con Air and this. And at the time, this was my favorite Nicolas Cage movie, having seen Leaving Las Vegas as well. Over time, I've gotten a greater appreciation for him. I mean, Moonstruck, for example, seen as a result of this show, I know he's a really great actor that's just had to make some weird decisions. This is one of his better ones, but I still don't think it's his best performance.
I've never been a fan of his until somewhat recently because of some... I mean, obviously Raising Arizona and, like you said, yeah. Moonstruck. And I mean, he's good in this. It was really these small, weird ones that he's been doing. Bad Lieutenant 2, and Mandy, of course, where it's just kind of like, okay, I can kind of... I think I get what he's doing. That said, it didn't affect my viewing of this at all. I was surprised, because especially Josh said, because I have been getting into the smaller Mom and Dad and the Army of One movies, maybe the crazy Nicolas Cage I'd be able to appreciate. And I didn't really think it was crazy Nicolas Cage. I think the character served a purpose. So.
Yeah, it's a really actually relatively calm Nicolas Cage, comparatively speaking. And I was kind of like, I was a little bit surprised. My memory had kind of pushed aside just how calm, like at times he's serene very early in the movie when they're walking out to their first the heart attack victim who opens the film. And they're bathed in that white heavenly light like angels. And he goes through that scene very calm and very serene. And it isn't even it's almost like a major tonal shift when he's back in the ambulance by himself and he's doing the voiceover and suddenly he becomes kind of manic. And then I was kind of almost put off by the shift in tone from him going to be very serene in the apartment and while he was doing the work on the patient to that sort of manic, I need a cup of coffee and I need some whiskey, guy. That was really surprising. It's still a very effective performance, I think, in the end, though.
My favorite scene in the whole film is when they go to this goth club, Ving Rhames and Nicolas Cage go on a call for a guy that's passed out. But he does, no one knows his name except his girlfriend of sorts. And so he goes by a name, I.B. Bangin'. And Ving Rhames does like a seance type of thing. And they're playing this crowd, making him think they're going to revive him with the word of God. And it's really just the anti-narcotic medicine that Nicolas Cage is shooting into him. But when Ving Rhames says, come on, I.B. Bangin', I mean...
That is the ultimate like dad name for a guy in a goth club. Like really, this is you're mixing up your cultures here. I think.
Yeah.
Maybe he was coming out with an album or something like that. That band was. Maybe they were like a goth fusion band.
I just think maybe Paul Schrader and Martin Scorsese were too old to know what the difference between goth and gang culture.
Possibly.
Goth and gangster rap combined. Someday.
It's already out there somewhere.
I'm sure it is. They'll start burning down churches, I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, there are scenes that are, like Josh mentioned, I mean, especially when they're in the ambulance, I enjoy the interaction with, like, John Goodman and, you know, and Tom Sizemore and all. But then it's kind of, I don't want to say few and far between, but there is moments of a lull, especially when he's looking at the dead girl in his dreams.
Yeah. And John Goodman just disappears. Just gone. And there's no explanation for why he's just not there. And that was another weird part of this. And I get that they wanted to get into the Ving Rhames and the Tom Sizemore characters, and that was going to be kind of thematically crazier going on. But they also built this thing between Goodman and Cage where they weren't really friends. He really kind of enjoyed kind of tormenting Goodman's character in a way and being kind of pushy towards him. And there was a spiky energy there that I was kind of enjoying, and then he's just gone and never comes back.
And it makes sense later on when you finally get there. But yeah, it does. In the moment, it's kind of like, okay, now we're on to Ving Rhames.
In the world of EMTs, you switch between partners often, and that part makes sense. This was adapted from a book, and so perhaps in the book, there's a slightly different way that the movie plays out to the point where maybe he is the unreliable narrator. Maybe it's the same partner the whole time, but it changes in the film. Now, that would have kind of worked for me, noting the insomniac alcoholic guy that Nicolas Cage was starting to become, that he can't quite keep personalities the same. That would have added to the mania of the film and would have been fine with me.
That could have worked. I just think it was simply three different days, three different partners for the day, which... they explain on day 2 to 3, but yeah. They do skip over from 1 to 2, which is weird. You'd think they'd do that with 1 to 2 and then not do it with 2 to 3, but whatever. It is what it is. And you almost need a plot to have an unreliable narrator, maybe. I don't know. But the movie works. It just, it's hard when you have so many things to compare it to.
Yeah.
Unfairly. So that's kind of where I'm at.
That's very true.
Since this is Aunt Bethany's 80th Christmas, I think she should lead us in the saying of grace.
What, dear? Grace! Grace! She passed away 30 years ago.
89.
There's a film from last week that I completely omitted, and probably for a good reason. It's the 6th Police Academy movie, City Under Siege. I just realized this now. But I saw Police Academy 6 in the theater on accident. When I got to the theater, me and my friend were supposed to see Ghost Dad. Now, for whatever reason, we haven't come across Ghost Dad turning 30. I'm going to go ahead and skip it anyways. But
what kind of nightmare universe were these two movies in the same theater at the same time?
1989, man. March of 89. All I remember is that my friend's mom took us to the theater. She told us what movie to see. She bought the tickets for us. She went to see something completely different. And we walk into Ghost Dad, and it's the last 5 minutes. We thought we were in a Twilight Zone situation. And us almost 10-year-olds had to figure out what we were going to do. So we decided to go sneak into Police Academy 6 instead. So we saw City Under Siege, and it sucked. It's dreadful. All of them are not good, okay? Right. But if you're going to put some nostalgia behind the first one for whatever reason, some good writers are at least involved in that movie, but
Gutenberg's kind of charming.
Sure.
And, but you don't have that in this one. He's not even there.
No, there's not even the boyish hints of promises of TNA to really get you going, I suppose. It's a total lost
effort. You don't even have Bobcat Goldthwait in this one, do you?
No. It's just like, Bubba Smith and David Graff and Michael Winslow doing their shtick.
Oh, God.
And in a movie directed by a guy named Peter Boners, there's no boners involved. So the smaller films in this week to get through really quickly. Rooftops, starring Jason Gedrick, directed by Robert Wise. I didn't watch that one. It barely made any money. Also, Slaves of New York. It's directed by James Ivory. This is the guy we've come to before, like the typical masterpiece theater English director who's going to give you a slice of white bread and ask you to devour it. But he surprised the shit out of me one time when A Room with a View turned 30. That's one of the great experiences of this show for me. It's a wonderful film. Helena Bonham Carter's first film role, and it's masterfully directed. But I didn't really have much of an interest in seeing this. The stars being Bernadette Peters and Chris Sarandon didn't get me interested enough to want to see it. But anybody else? No?
You don't have Ghost Dead on here at all.
I know! And that memory...
Were you protesting something?
I mean, I would now. I don't want to... Come on, let's be honest. In 5 minutes of Ghost Dad, I got all that I needed for the rest of my life. I mean, it ends happily. I remember that.
Looking through all these movies, I realized that I had a shot to see something in the theater, and I wasn't able to, so it was not... Because this is the first year I got to the theater. I don't know if it's Honey, I Shrunk the Kids or Batman, but Prancer... Well, maybe Prancer was later on, but I couldn't go because it was sold out every freaking theater time we tried to go see it.
To see Ghost Dad?
Prancer.
Prancer. Oh, Prancer. Okay.
We'll get to that later on. I'll retell a story when Prancer comes out. Anyway, go ahead.
Next one. We hated the first movie as a collective podcast, and the sequel I have seen portions of on like HBO and whatnot, but Fletch Lives.
Ugh.
Nothing about Fletch makes me ever want to see another version of that in any way, shape, or form.
I Chevy Chase in small doses. Like, I don't mind a joke here and there. As a whole movie, I have a hard time. There's too many misses to enjoy the jokes. I don't know.
You're not Groucho Marx, Chevy. It just doesn't work. You're not that quick.
Ouch.
He's not even Richard Marx.
Ba-dum-bum.
Some 89 references? Okay. Every time I bring up something adult contemporary, Bob.
Just like that, his soul leaves his body for a moment.
I mean, I did own one of his records.
Repeat Offender. Absolutely.
Actually, I have two of them now. I liked... When he did the Hazard song, I like came back into the... I love this Hazard guy.
That's his third album.
I couldn't even tell you what that song sounds like anymore.
Oh, I could sing it for you if you wanted me to right now. But
no, I'm good. Okay. What was the first one? Was that with like Should've Known Better and all that?
Should've Known Better, Endless Summer
Nights.
That's
the one I had.
Don't Mean Nothing.
Didn't have the second one.
Okay.
Fuck that shit.
This is my mom's wheelhouse here is Richard Marx.
I've interviewed him before. Anyway, continue.
Nice guy.
Yeah.
Cub fan.
Oh, good. Oh, yeah. Hazard. The video for Hazard is he's got a Cubs jersey on in the video, if I'm not mistaken.
Did he kill his girlfriend or is she dead? Yeah, it's something about that. I mean, that was a kid. It was a long time ago.
Oh, my God. I can't believe you spent this much time on Richard Marx.
Your fault. Anyway.
The last one of the week that turned 30 is my first rated R film in the theater, Leviathan. I wasn't quite 10 years old yet, but I had already seen Alien and Aliens, and the way that my mom figured it, well, what's the harm in letting him see another film that kept screaming in the marketing an alien ripoff? And that's exactly what it is. It's the second of three underwater monster movies of 1989, Deep Star 6 being the first that we discussed. And if you're going to set the bar at Deep Star 6, Leviathan is fine. Okay. It is not nearly the horrific piece of garbage that one is. At least it has Ron Cobb designing the production and the monster involved. Richard Crenna and Peter Weller are fine actors. It beats Greg Evigan. Okay, we'll take that. And I mean, like Ernie Hudson is in this too. Hector Elizondo, Amanda Pays, who's an actress that I didn't hear of before and haven't heard of since this movie. It's directed by George P. Cosmatos of Tombstone fame. But it's
Son of Mandy fame.
Yes. So it comes around on that too. Now, Leviathan is not a terrible, terrible movie, honestly, because if you just watch it with low expectations, it fills all of your particular needs, I suppose. It's got fine production value, honestly. It has a fine score to accompany that. It's got all of your typical things that happen, though. Okay, like I forgot to bitch about Captive State giving us the blow by in the first few minutes by giving us overlapping radio broadcasts, which I hate that shit. Leviathan has all your typical stuff. It's corporate espionage, and the company's the bad guys, and they're just the working stiffs that for some reason still call all of each other by their last names. I never will understand that.
Or weird nicknames.
Yes. Yes, like Six Pack in this movie is Daniel Stern. It's got something that even...
That?
Ooh, Ice Protector.
Jeez. There's even like a face hugger type of creature in this thing. And the whole plot device of this is kind of interesting in that the film's called Leviathan because there was a Russian submarine that actually sunk a long time ago. This movie decides to say that people were being experimented on when they investigate this sub, then they've, you know, contracted this deadly mutating virus, and mutation is the name of the game here. It's not an alien, okay? Believe it or not, it's not. So, like I said, it's okay. If your expectations are very low, the monster value is kind of high here. So I'll give it credit for that. Meg Foster, you guys know who she is, especially you from zombie film, Rob Zombie movie.
Evelyn. The zombie movie.
They Live. She's in They Live as well.
And then Lords of Salem. That's right. She's naked in that.
Okay. She's really, got really some old. Of the most captivating eyes you'll ever see. Especially for a brunette, that's kind of an odd combo there. And she's the corporate bad person here whose hair is slicked back and she's got shoulder pads riding up to her ears. And the best part of the whole movie is at the end when she's saying, I guess the hurricane blew away after all, blah, blah, blah. And then Peter Deller just decks her. I mean, and that's where the film ends. It's throwaway, but I did have some fun revisiting the first rated R theater film I ever saw.
I really didn't enjoy this at all.
Really. Because Sean decided to watch it and analyze it. Shot by shot, scene by scene.
Not quite. Daniel Stern is insufferable. Just from moment one, I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand listening to him talk. He just irritated the hell out of me. And even when his character is killed off, I didn't care. And it didn't make him any less irritating to me.
No,
honestly.
He's still moving. After he's dead, for crying out loud.
This, you know what this movie reminded me of, though, in terms of the special effects, was that movie we did as a classic last year with the giant orgy that melted together.
Oh, yeah. Society.
They did that in this movie where the characters essentially kind of melt into each other, where you just see like Richard Crenna's melted face as part of like a huge mass of skin.
The whole idea is that, if I'm not mistaken, there's Ron Cobb who did the production design for this one, and there's a guy named Rob Botten. I'm not sure that they worked together on this one, but Rob Botten is the guy that did the special effects for The Thing, with all of the mutated parts and the spindly legs and everything. And you can see a lot of the influence of The Thing on the monster. It's just not done as well. It's less of a practical effect and more of a simple rubbery amalgam in this one.
I just didn't care for it at all. I didn't buy into these characters. And I read Janet Maslin's review in the New York Times, and she kind of hit upon something that really made me laugh. She called it the survival of the prettiest. Because they're really the prettiest characters are the ones who come out at the end.
Yeah, and poor Ernie Hudson, like, he drowns. At the end, he's on top of the surface, but he drowned.
That's the role of the noble black man in the '80s movie. He's got to sacrifice himself to save the cute white people.
Yeah, and the cute woman who's
no one did it better than Ernie Hudson.
Yeah, he was able to sign up for this movie because they couldn't get Eddie Murphy.
Oh, what?
Well, that's the joke for Ghostbusters, right? They wanted Eddie Murphy. They couldn't. They got Ernie Hudson. I feel bad for the man because I do like him. You know, he's got redeeming roles in, like, The Crow, but not in this one.
That was not me joking about, really? That was me joking that that's obvious nonsense.
Oh, yeah. Of course. Of course.
There were two other small movies, Rooftops and Slaves of New York.
You did those.
Don't, did you?
Yeah,
I was
remember.
Not paying attention. That is our show next week. Next week we have Us.
Yes, we will be back.
Yes.
Ba-dum-bum.
Jordan Peele movie. He's also going to host this new Twilight Zone TV show. They're bringing it back. So we're going to do the Twilight Zone movie. It is currently on YouTube for $2.99. If you want to watch it with us, unless you own it. We'll also probably go back to Triple Frontier because I'd imagine you guys will watch it. We may stream some other movies if we feel like it, unless something crazy comes out. Who knows?
No, it's not going to happen.
Climax isn't coming?
I wish. No. I checked. There's nothing else coming other than Us.
Great. But yeah, so that's next week. Probably streaming challenge, Us, Triple Frontier. I'm looking forward to it, though. I can't wait to see what Us is, because I don't have a freaking clue. I do want to thank our Patreon supporters. We'll start with our Key Grip level with Charlie Messing and the Hall of Famer Jason Bryant. Our character actors, Josh Paul, Christina Cato, and Cousin Jeff.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Our special effects level, Corey from IVNV and Sarah Morrell.
May the force be with you.
Our associate producer, Jason Mollett.
Everybody has to eat shaving cream once in a while.
And our movie stars, Dave Sievers and Uncle Jeff.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
If you want to be a supporter, head over to ihatecritics.net/Patreon to get yourself a credit on the show. If you want to help us improve our rating on iTunes after the Canadian knocked us down a little bit, please go there and support the show. Also, tell your friends about it. We will read your review on the air. But, yeah, let your friends know about the show. And if you want some of our merch, ihatecritics.net, click on the podcast merch tab and get yourself something to help support the podcast. Otherwise, we'll see you next week.
That ought to do it. Thanks very much, Ray.
And we're the three best friends that anybody could have. We're the three best friends that anyone could have. We're the three best friends that anyone can have. And we'll never, ever, 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 ever leave each other. We're the best three friends that anybody could have. I mean, the three best friends that anybody could have. That's right, the three best friends that anyone
could have. Graduate American History X.
American History X.
I'll go with The Graduate due to the soundtrack.
I'll go with American History X due to my first viewing of it. Christmas Story, Natural Born Killers. This is kind of a fun week.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Movies we don't like that much that a lot of people do.
Christmas Story, I guess.
I'm going to go blow my Fishing with Gandhi load early.
I'll go to Natural Born Killers and just reset it. Election, The Lost Boys.
Election.
It's too easy. Final Destination 2, Garden State. The Mothman Prophecies, Being John Malkovich.
Agreed.
I hate The Mothman
Prophecies. It's such a terrible movie.
And too many people liked it when it came out.
Never understood that.
True Romance or Swingers?
True Romance.
It's hard for me. I'd probably go Swingers, but I do like them both. The Full Monty, Ratatouille. Hitch, War Games. Aliens, The Flintstones.
Aliens!
The Terminator, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
2003. Oh, Terminator, please, Terminator.
That was very sneaky. The Terminator.
The Muppet Movie, National Lampoon's Vacation.
Which one was it?
The 1979 Muppet Movie or Vacation 1983?
Muppet Movie.
Muppet Movie.
Yeah, probably. I do like Vacation. Drive, which I don't know if you've seen yet, have you?
I haven't.
Signs.
Want to switch it to another one? Or?
Yeah, that way I don't have to... Well, it's Drive, I guess, but... I do like Signs. Galaxy Quest or Team America World Police?
Galaxy Quest.
Team America.
Team America. Taxi Driver, Citizen Kane.
Wow. I got to go Citizen Kane, but I mean, that's awesome.
I really do mean it when I say Citizen Kane. It's not a pretentious, like, I want to sound cool because of it. I really do love that movie. It's modern in its way. And
well, yeah, and I mean, I just love the whole Rosebud idea. You know, I mean, it exists in other movies. I think Social Network has it. I even think Lords of Chaos has it in a certain weird way.
Yeah.
And I just love movies that have that, and that's the best of all of them. So, but, I mean, Taxi Driver was fantastic. Blade Runner, Richie Rich.
Blade Runner.
Twilight, New Moon, Batman 89.
Batman 89.
Yeah, I haven't seen the Twilight films.
Josh can't vote. Full Metal Jacket, Back to the Future.
Full Metal Jacket.
Back to the Future.
Jesus Christ, that's hard.
It is hard.
I mean, I'd watch Back to the Future first, even though I think Full Metal Jacket's better. I'm going Back to the Future. Lucky Number 11, Final Destination.
Lucky Number 11.
Agreed. Slightly underrated movie.
Yep. Rocky Balboa, Sky Captain, and the World of Tomorrow.
Rocky Balboa. Sky Captain's a piece of garbage. Hot, like that movie? Flaming garbage.
As a completely just innovative, like, completely have to be in a good mood type of movie, you might watch Sky Captain, but it's Rocky Balboa.
I mean, it's a 60-year-old man fighting. That's innovative.
He's fighting a dude named Mason the Lion Dixon.
It's fantastic writing. Batman Forever, Spider-Man 2.
Spider-Man 2.
Spider-Man 2.
The same Raimi one. Enchanted Zombieland.
Huh, that's a little harder than you might think, honestly, because Enchanted is actually really clever. I'll go Zombieland, but it's close for me.
I haven't seen Enchanted, but I do like Zombieland, so
I'm going Zombieland, but I really Enchanted's kind of my serendipity, if you will.
That's high praise, man.
I didn't mean it that way.
See, the thing about Enchanted is, other people liked it, like critics and stuff too. I know that.
Whereas... I don't want to put like I remember like something like The Hangover. I don't want to put something like that kind of hype on it and then have you go see it and be like, what the fuck?
Anything that is recommended to me, I'm always considering. But, you know, when you say serendipity, that does put me on a particular level. Your serendipity. But the one that pretty much nobody else likes, but like people just like you, you know, or it's an unpopular opinion to say.
Okay, maybe I don't really know the buzzer on Enchanted. Maybe I'm wrong.
It's not the type of movie that you're supposed to like.
Right.
Yeah, and I wasn't supposed to like Serendipity. It was another romantic comedy and a string of them that I'd been dragged to with the promise of free popcorn. And this one was the first film post September 11th as well. It hit me perfectly.
Like Satan's not in it.